Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40, created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster, Sam Baker. Today's guest, Anita Bagwandas, is that rare thing, a beauty journalist who's prepared to call out the beauty industry. Anita is currently a beauty columnist on The Guardian, but throughout her career, she has worked on some of the biggest names in women's magazines and consulted for some of the most famous brands. It's not exactly the CV of someone you'd expect to see campaigning to break free of prevailing beauty standards. But Anita's new book, Ugly, does just that, by examining how women are trapped by the way we're supposed to look, regarded as lesser if our face doesn't fit, if we're not white with Caucasian features and hair, if we're not size 10, if we're not 25.
Quite often there isn't the inspiration to see that there's another way to do things, or, you know, actually that's fine if you don't have that. You might have it a little bit later or might not have it, but actually that's fine and that's all okay. You are just shown this one way to live as a woman in particular, whereas I feel like men get a lot more, you know, you could be this bachelor doing all kinds of things, and whereas we don't necessarily get that choice.
Anita joined me to talk about the first time she felt wrong, growing up in a world of Barbie, and how her perverse inner masochist led her to end up working in the very industry that made her feel not good enough. Plus, she takes us on a whistle-stop tour of anti-aging beauty advertising, tells us why otherwise smart women fall for the promise of glow, by which I mean me, and probably you, and why middle age is such an utterly pointless term. If you want to see off beauty anxiety, start right here.
Well, thank you so much for coming on The Shift. I'm delighted to have you. You're probably not quite old enough.
39. Are
you? 39. Nearly. And it was really interesting to me listening to you talking about the male gaze and the way it starts to move away from you in your 30s, because I'm a lot older than you. I didn't know whether it was fascinating or depressing. You feel like it's already happening at that point.
Yeah.
To me, definitely. That's so young.
So this is interesting. I think this might be a sort of a more tech related development, but you definitely notice on dating apps, being single as well, there's a huge drop off as soon as you hit 35. So I remember when that happened, and lots of friends of mine would sort of lie about their ages so that they stayed in that under 35 category. And yeah, that's a definite thing. And I think because of that, and because people meet each other, you know, less organically these days, and so much dating is done through apps, I think that's a really big thing. And I think that's put a big emphasis on that, actually. So I think that's been an interesting modern shift.
Dating apps just terrify anybody who hasn't been out there for a little while. A friend of mine, God, this was back on Red, and she was dating. It was online dating, but it wasn't dating apps. And she had a date with this guy who was admitting to 50, and she was probably about 37 or 38 at the time. And she was like, oh, I don't know, it's too old, maybe I won't go. And I was like, oh, well, my husband's 10 years older than me and it works fine. So, you know, go, give him a chance. And she got there, and the first thing he said to her was, oh, I nearly didn't come because you're outside my age bracket.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you handle that?
It's really tough. And I think I've got male friends who are sort of, you know, probably like late 30s, early 40s, and date women sort of generally like who are about 30, and sort of like that's probably their like bracket. They wouldn't necessarily go any higher than that. And I have asked them about that. I'm like, why would you, like, why? and they don't necessarily have a reason, and it's something they just do. And I think, and this is a huge generalization, it's not obviously not true for everyone, but I think particularly for the people I know, and let's hope they maybe don't listen to this, but it's because they haven't necessarily gotten to the place in their career as they would want to, and so don't necessarily feel like if they perhaps were dating someone of the same age who maybe was, you know, fairly well established in their career, like it would make them feel bad. I think there is a sort of slightly ego.
Oh, wow, really?
Just from app dating and men I've met and male friends, I think that's my take on it. I think they just don't feel ready enough for it, or they need to buy themselves more time to get to that place in their careers. And yeah.
Because I always assumed it was like a baby thing, that maybe men are in their late 30s, they've got all the time in the world, and so women of their own age are a bit more like, I'm looking for the baby father. This is where my brain is at. But the idea that basically they don't want a woman of their own age because she's going to be too self-contained and too successful is really fucking depressing, isn't it?
That success thing, I can't tell you the number of dates I've been on with men who I have thought have been successful, and they just turned around and been like, almost like sort of slightly threatened by my success, or almost they've almost seen it's a reflection on them. They're a little bit sort of like, oh, I don't know, they're just like, oh, I think you're too successful for me, or like you're too out of my league is like the phrase like you get a lot. And I'm just like, wow, this is, I don't know, I really like to like date people who I think have amazing careers or like really interesting passions, whatever it is, because it keeps me on my toes and I'm like, oh, amazing, you know, like,
yeah,
it keeps me going. I find that inspiring, but I don't know if that is necessarily the case for everyone. But yeah, it's interesting. I think particularly with more women going to university and, you know, that sort of thing, I wonder if that is the flip side of that.
God, that's really bloody depressing. I almost wish we hadn't started this conversation now, so really.
At least you're not single.
I know. It might be cheering. There's a number of women that I spoke to for The Shift when I was writing the book who said that actually they had a lot more success with much younger men.
Yes, yeah.
And that much younger men were fully up for dating older women, and it was actually men in their late 30s and 40s who had kind of Leonardo DiCaprio syndrome, you know. The women just kept getting younger and younger.
So interestingly, I think this might be a generational thing, because a lot of those men have probably had therapy or a little bit more open to that, whereas I still think for lots of men in their sort of late 30s and 40s, some have had therapies, you know, but like some haven't. And I think that's quite a different generational thing. And that sort of openness to talking about feelings and stuff, I think, is a bit of a generation thing. So yeah, that's true. Might be something in that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I obviously want to like talk a lot about aging and the beauty industry and, you know, how we got to this place where aging was ugly, for want of a better way of putting it, to kind of use your phrase. But first, let's talk a little bit about you to give you some context. So can you tell us a little bit about Little Anita and your own relationship with, I suppose, the beauty industrial complex, for a better way of putting it?
Yeah, Little Anita didn't have a concept of whether she was beautiful or ugly or anything like that, really, until I was probably about four-ish, and at a party somebody basically told me that I was too big for an outfit, a costume, at this fancy dress party. And it was a really distinctive moment for me, because it almost felt quite visceral. It was sort of like I just knew I was being told there was something wrong with me. And I guess even before that, I had picked up messaging, but it was the first time that someone external had like said that to me. And the first chapter of my book is essentially unpicking this alongside the help of sort of psychology and stuff. But I kept getting these messages about the fact that I just wasn't the beauty standard. I wasn't ideal. There were lots of things about me that were wrong and undesirable and, you know, ugly, for want of a better word. And I just kept getting those messages over and over and over again. And I think if something tells you that over and over again, you do eventually start to believe it. And over the years, then as I got older and into my sort of teens and etc., I had just been told so many times from everything that I'd experienced, you know, from external sources, from the cartoons I watched as a kid, you know, there were never any Disney princesses who weren't the same, essentially. All of this messaging just sort of built up to have this sort of real hold over the way I thought about myself and my appearance. And I didn't have anything to almost like counteract that in a way.
And that norm was basically skinny, white and blonde.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. And growing up in the sort of 90s as well, with the whole sort of size zero thing and the noughties, yeah, there was a definite way to be beautiful and it was very narrow.
Where did you grow up? Was it Wales?
Wales, yeah.
Was it a very mixed area or was it a very white area?
Parts of it were quite mixed. In my school, there were definitely a fair amount of Asian children in my school, but past that, it wasn't super diverse. And it still definitely sort of stuck to the beauty standards that everyone else had, you know, like to be the most popular girls were always the sort of archetypal pretty girls that you would imagine, the girl next door. And there was still very much a beauty standard that everyone was following. So although there was a little bit of diversity, it didn't really make much of a difference when you're still being told the same messaging.
It was a line, I think you said, the pretty girls at school never leave you. And that's so true, isn't it? That it can start at 4 or 5, or maybe you're a little bit older, and then that's kind of it. You know, I mean, I can still remember that feeling. And also being the third one in a friendship group, always being number 3.
Yeah, that feeling, I don't think, leaves you, even if you rationalise it, etc. I guess when those things happen in your childhood, they do start to form a part of your self-esteem and your sort of, I guess I call it, I think, an invisible tagline in the book, but they sort of start to become how you see yourself.
Yeah, you use an analogy a few times called an imaginary backpack of self-loathing, which I really loved. And I think I'm sure so many people listening will really identify with that. That kind of every time one of those little things chips away at you, you just like store it.
Yeah.
It just gradually becomes heavier and heavier. It's such a good analogy. Have you still got that backpack?
I definitely do, yeah. I don't think it's as easy as just reading a book or, you know, maybe having a little bit of therapy or like doing, you know, to clear that kind of level of, I guess, almost just discomfort in yourself. It just doesn't happen overnight. And I think this is the issue that with sort of our modern sort of, I don't know, body positivity and self-love and everything, we're told it's gone from you have to be thin and you have to look a certain way to be pretty. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, you can be yourself. Like there is a huge gap in between that. And it's not just a switch that flicks. You don't just empty that backpack of self-loathing and it's all right. There are still things I struggle with, absolutely. And there are good days and bad days, but definitely through all the work I've done on the book and other work as well, you know, therapy and lots of different things, I have managed to turn a bit of a corner on a few issues for sure. So there are definitely things I'm much more at peace with, but I'm not like walking around being like, oh my God, I'm so hot like that. Yeah. But I definitely am more peaceful, I would say.
I was going to say, if you've managed to literally empty that backpack and wander off, then literally you could sell that. You could be a very rich woman just teaching that. So it was kind of slightly masochistic to want to work in the beauty industry.
Yes. Yeah, I've had to really look at that. I think it was a therapist when I was younger who pointed that out, because I hadn't ever made that connection. But when I was writing the book, it really dawned on me. I mean, the reason I became so obsessed with beauty products when I was younger, and I was really obsessed with them. I had more makeup than any of my friends put together. It was the thing I spent all my money on. And even at university, it was the thing I spent all my money on. You know, the reason I did that was partially because I had to go above and beyond to try and find products for my skin color, because this might seem unimaginable to people now, but like there was just nothing. There was literally nothing. Like I do remember, I think the darkest, my mum had the same compact. We both had the same one. And the darkest powder was probably someone of like a sort of middle-ish olive skin tone. You know, I've got dark South Indian skin. Like, yeah, there was just no way. They just weren't the products. And even in like nearby in Cardiff, there was nothing in Cardiff either. So it was like, there was just nothing. So you were either having to make do with products made for white skin, or I kept just trying to mix stuff and like try and make my own things. And so I had to go in above and beyond to try and find solutions. So I think that's part of the reason I was obsessed with beauty, but also because I was obsessed with what beauty could potentially give you. And that for me, it was, I hoped it might open these like magical doors to this realm where I would finally feel like I was beautiful or pretty and attractive. And I was always looking for that. And I put loads and loads of hope on beauty products. So I just was obsessed with them. Like I just loved it. I loved it so much. And I can see that hope sometimes in people I meet and people who message me. And I can see it online just from watching people where, you know, products will get wait lists because they've got clever names and, you know, the brand, you know, the marketing and stuff has been well done. And they think it is sort of like a jar of hope. And I can see that playing out for people.
For you, was it makeup or was it moisturiser?
More makeup, because I had quite oily skin when I was younger. And I was always trying to mattify it, which again, you know, a lot of dark people with dark skin do have oily skin, and you're sort of taught that it's bad for some reason, and it's really not actually at all. And I wish I was as oily as I used to be, but yeah, it was mostly makeup actually. I was trying to always like put my face on to be pretty, or my hair as well. I would always try and find straightening products, and I could always blow dry it straight and try and avoid the rain, which was really hard in Wales growing up because it rained every day.
So yeah.
Mainly hair and makeup.
I mean, was there a sense with wanting to go into magazines and into fashion and beauty journalism, wanting to make change, or was it wanting to fit in?
It was a weird combination of both. I've never really fit in. I've always sort of marched to my own beat a little bit. I knew I wasn't going to fit in, and that was fine because I just wanted to see more than magazines were giving people and giving me, which is the ideas I always pitch for, like, sort of almost like quite progressive and always too progressive. Then the other part of me, once you're in that environment with lots of people who, you know, come from similar backgrounds, might all look the same, or like you come into an environment that has a set of values, you do want to fit in because nobody wants to feel like they're the odd one out or not welcome or not valued or, you know, othered in some way. So you do want to fit in. And yeah, I definitely wanted that and wanted, I guess, in some ways to have a part of or experience what it would feel like to be that kind of amazing, glossy magazine person. So there was definitely a part of that for sure. But yeah, I definitely was always very driven by wanting to create change.
Yeah, because it struck me when we kind of crossed on and off a long time ago, but also then looking at your biography before we started recording, there's this really interesting mix of, like, you know, working for all those big titles and, you know, getting right to the heart of the kind of magazine beauty industry. But also you've never really been afraid to stand up to those guys. To subvert, maybe not the right word, but to start to question them and to kind of question what we're being sold.
Yeah, I've always had quite a strong sense of, I guess, what I thought was right and wrong. Yeah, even when I was an assistant, I would challenge loads of stuff. And I was really lucky when I worked at Stylist in particular, that the sort of mandate there was very much, you know, we try all the products and we make sure you don't, like, it was almost anti what so many of the magazines had been sort of peddling for years, with this, like, sort of like fake beauty journalism speak and, you know, and sort of, you know, that sort of like slightly disempowering, disingenuous way. So, like, it really fit me, actually, because I was able to sort of have an opinion and have a voice and think differently and that sort of thing. And, you know, there's obviously definitely been times in my career when I've had to write things I didn't want to write or wasn't maybe fully allowed to express how I felt. And, you know, there is always a balance with those things. And for me, I've always sort of thought, right, okay, so what's the greater good here? If I can make a little bit of change here, even if I don't say everything I think, then that's probably better. If I can help or reflect or speak to some people, that's better than me not speaking to anyone. And that's always been my thought with that. It's better to be in the inside making change than it is to be shouting from the outside, I guess.
Yeah, totally. The celebrity beauty routine pieces, you know, and I suppose the equivalent now would be how I get it done. There are always somebody flogging something and they always make you feel absolutely shit, even as the person who's writing them. Because
yeah,
you don't have a 10-product routine. Or do you have a 10-product routine? I don't know. Maybe I should ask you what your celebrity beauty routine is.
God, it's a hit and miss of whatever I can grab. Sometimes it's really extensive. And then some days I will just rub whatever I can find on my face. Yeah, those routines, I was just like, this is just made up and fake. Like, it's pointless. I don't think it's good for people.
Yeah, I mean, I remember always feeling like that about Anna Wintour's morning routine. You know, like, they get up at 5, play tennis, and then, you know, the hairdresser will come around and you'll have a blow dry, and then you get to your desk at 7 and your Starbucks and your muffin are always waiting. But, you know, the only thing that we had in common there was the Starbucks and the muffin, and it was like never waiting. And the difference was I ate it. Where do you think it comes from, the way that kind of beauty anxiety, as you phrase it? Do you think that was always built into the beauty industry, or do you think it emerged?
If we sort of say that the industry, I guess, started in the sort of Victorian era as a proper industry, I think it has always been there, because you can actually see it in very early adverts. And I guess the first way it was really sold to us was in terms of celebrity endorsements. And that's very subtle, because a lot of those early sort of, you know, sort of silent movie stars would be selling like soaps. It was quite often a soap or a face powder. What it's selling you is like, if you buy this, you will look like me. And then it sets up this person as an ideal. And so there is anxiety there, whether we want to, you know, whether we can see that or not. There's a sort of you and me, us and them thing there. So we get it from there. And then as time goes on, and particularly in the sort of Second World War, in the post Second World War period, there is a real shift in advertising, and the anxiety is, it's so obvious, and it's playing on women's desperation. It's really, yeah, it's really sad. And at the time there was like a lack of men, basically, because obviously lots of men were at war and there'd been lots of casualties, and it's sort of using this desperation of women to sell more beauty products. And from there onwards, I think you can see how there is a bit of a change in how much that anxiety ramps up. But generally speaking, until fairly recently, I think that anxiety has still been a really big part of how beauty products are sold and how magazines are sold and how lots of things are sold to women, actually, and men. There are things sold to men like that too, in terms of, like, you know, weight gain or like bodybuilding stuff, or, you know, that sort of that side of things, or like hair growth and all of that. But yeah, there is a definite anxiety that is being sold to people.
It struck me as quite interesting that some of the biggest names and the earliest names in beauty, like Estee Lauder, Elizabeth Arden, Helena Rubinstein, they're women. Not exclusively women behind it, but there are powerful women behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the really inspiring stories. You know, we still have those modern stories today, you know, like people like Jo Malone, etc. Amazing. There's so many brilliant founders. And that's really inspiring. I guess I think as you go along further into history, particularly at that sort of mid-century period, that's when advertising starts to come in a completely different new way. And those ad companies are run by men, and they are generally run by white men. And I think that in particular period is when things become really toxic, and then it really all starts to shift. And I think we are living with the impact of that. You know, that's people's parents or their grandparents. You know, those beauty standards from that time affect people we know, and like can be passed through generations, etc., etc. So I think that attitude is still present in our society in different ways. And I think that was a period that really shifted things.
Do you think the beauty standards that you absorbed, did that come from home or the kids at school?
That definitely came from a mix of what I was seeing on TV and all the cartoons and my Barbies. I've got this picture of, because I was so obsessed with my dolls and I loved Barbie. And I've got this picture and I had loads and loads of Barbies. They're all just sat. I used to put on little sort of like fashion shows and like photo shoots with them, and they're all sort of lined up, and they're all like, it's really telling. There are all these thin white dolls. And I just look at that picture and I'm like, wow, there is no wonder. Like there was no other way that could have turned out. So between that and then what I was seeing on TV through all the Disney stuff, you know, going to school, and I really vividly remember the teachers always cooing over this, like there were some particular girls who had like very, very long blonde hair, and they were always cooing over them. And you know, as a child, you can't help but go, oh, okay, so that's what's beautiful, because no one's doing that to me with my like frizzy curly hair. No one's doing that to me. And so all of those things stacked up, because yeah, it was definitely not what was happening at home, because my parents are very like not bothered about appearances at all. My mum doesn't really bother with beauty very much. She's not, she just doesn't really care. So that isn't an attitude I was brought up with at home. So that's really interesting. That is definitely an external thing. That's definitely not part of the culture I was brought up with at home, for sure. So yeah, that's fascinating, because that is all external.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it didn't counteract it at all. And so many people what you talk to, when they talk about their body image issues or diets or even grooming, they will be the kids stuff, but they'll also say, oh yeah, my mum spent the whole of the 1980s on the F-plan diet or whatever. But you weren't getting any of that at home.
No, my mum does not care about that at all. Never mentioned anti-aging, does not care at all.
How interesting. So her approach to aging is just bring it on.
Yeah, she just doesn't even factor in, wouldn't even factor into her. And I do think that is a little bit more of an Indian attitude to things, because I think, you know, even for women, there is largely speaking more of a focus on education and, you know, that being the sort of marker of things rather than appearance. So much of this messaging is subliminal, and it is, you know, you sort of just take it in and sort of internalize it, and it would probably never have occurred to me to go, oh, why don't I look like that, or, you know, which is something I've heard a lot of, you know, a lot of friends of mine who do have kids, that's something that they have said to me, particularly if you've got friends who've got children, friends of color who've got children who are also of color, quite often, you know, they have heard their children say stuff like why aren't I like white and pretty, and, you know, and so this pattern is still going.
My granddaughter is half Korean, and she came back from school when she was about 5 saying, why can't I be a princess? Just like, oh man.
Yeah, it's very true. Literally, someone earlier was just saying to me that every time in the school nativity every year, Mary was always blonde. And there are just these things that just affect children from such a young age, even if they seem sort of relatively insignificant.
Yeah, one point you say in the book that you were taught to fear aging long before you started to experience it. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, this is again another interesting thing, because definitely didn't get that from my home. There was no worry about aging in my family at all. My mum doesn't care. She still doesn't care. She's in her 70s. She just does not care. She's never used an anti-aging cream. She just doesn't factor into her life. But you do, and I guess I really unpicked this when I was researching the book, but pretty much every older woman in the cartoons I was watching or the Disney stories I was watching, the older women are always wicked or evil or demonized in some way. And they're very jealous of, you know, youth in some way. You know, they're always like, that's what they're looking for. They just want, you know, they want that magic pill that's going to make them youthful. And so you're set up to fear aging, which is really terrible. And the way that sort of like frames older women in our society is awful. And you sort of see that, I think, as well in sort of culture where it's always the mum that is like nagging. Like they just think the mother is always set up to be just not this aspirational figure.
Yeah, which is the boring one, really, the nagging one.
It's always that. Even like in Christmas films, you see this all the time. You know, it's the widowed dad. And like, why is it never like, it's never the mum who's like the hero for having to like, you know, raise a kid on her own or whatever it is. So I think we just have that narrative in pretty much all of our entertainment and everything we engage with. I don't know, I think it just is so limiting for women and it's so deeply unfair.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested that you said at the beginning of the chapter about aging that it took you a long time to write it because it felt too close for comfort.
Yeah, I think because I am in my late 30s, it's a really funny time. Weirdly, I have always struggled with not so much the aging process, but with getting older and what that means. You know, we are told what it is to be like the ideal 30-year-old woman or, you know, the ideal 40-year-old woman or what, you know, whatever that looks like. And if you don't measure up to that, quite often there isn't the inspiration to see that there's another way to do things or, you know, actually that's fine if you don't have that. You might have it a little bit later or you might not have it, but actually that's fine and that's all okay. You are just shown this one way to live as a woman in particular. Whereas I feel like men get a lot more, you know, you could be this bachelor doing all kinds of things. And whereas we don't necessarily get that choice. And I think, yeah, for me with the aging, because I have started to see the first signs of physical aging as well. Yeah, it's been a struggle for me because I've sort of been battling against what I know I believe is right in that I think we've been done a huge disservice in the focus on anti-aging and the obsession with youth being the only way to be beautiful, but also feeling the effects of having grown up in that myself. And I definitely feel that too. And I really hate that I feel that. And I think for me, the way forward is just in a much more conscious, quite gentle way and not making any rash decisions. I don't have any tweakments or anything like that, but I might not rule them out in the future because I know that I am a product of, you know, my society and the way I've grown and what I've grown up in. But I would like to find a way to age that isn't terrified of it or hating the way I look. And I think that was the point of that chapter for me, was to just have a bit more ease with getting older and to sort of see some positives and to understand why we have focused on youth for women as the only way to be beautiful.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, in reality, you look great when you're younger, but you also just have a different kind of beauty that evolves as you get older. And yeah, I just think there's just another way.
Yeah. Do you feel like you know where to look for that other way?
No, not at all, because you don't see it very often. And when you're presented with someone who has aged gracefully, which is a term I really hate in itself, like who decides that's graceful and what isn't, and what does that even mean? Like, for me, graceful is quiet, and it's somebody who's aged quietly, hasn't made a fuss, and that's patriarchal control. That's not, I don't know, I think the older you get, the more you should say, because you've got more experience and you've lived more, and there's more value in that to me than, I don't know, a teenager maybe saying stuff. And that's not that they shouldn't have their opinion too, they absolutely should, but I don't know, I just think we don't have enough reverence for older people in sort of Western society, in a way that I do see actually in my Indian culture, that there is a lot more respect for older people and the wisdom of older people. And I think that's definitely something that I would like to see more examples of, women being allowed to be themselves and age the way they want to age, or be the way they want to be at different ages. And I just don't think we see enough of it across the board, film, TV, radio, magazines, everything.
I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It's the visibility issue, but it's how women are or aren't allowed to age, because it's like, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't have tweakments, which I absolutely hate the word tweakments, because it's like, it feels to me like it's set up to make it sound like it's not, oh, it's nothing, it's just a little tweak. But it's like, age gracefully, but don't go grey, don't have wrinkles, but don't overdo it, don't look fake, gotta look natural and ages. And it's like, oh my God. I mean, I'm sure there'll be some bloke on Twitter who would say to me, men do feel like that too, and I'm sure that they do a bit, but the reality is that an aging man traditionally has gravitas and, you know, prosperous and has power and status, and frankly, white aging men, because let's call it what it is white aging men, have had it all their own way for such a long time. And it feels to me like the beauty industry has been really, really instrumental in making sure that women don't.
Yeah, I think traditionally it has actually, and I think that's very telling, the fact the anti-aging industry really sort of shot up in sort of the 80s, when the whole advertising thing was, I think that was another one of its peaks. And as I said, advertising companies are generally run by, you know, white men, and they have worked together almost like side by side to sell people anxiety and insecurity. And it's really sad, because I just think it limits so many people. And yeah, it just makes what should be, you know, a more confident period of your life, you know, after coming through the struggles of your 20s, etc., it just takes away a lot of joy for a lot of people, I think. And they're already worried about how they're going to look, you know, when they get older, or they're already, you know, you sort of get to 30 and people are already, I always remember there wasn't really any chat about injectables or anything like that until, I remember, as we started to get to sort of like 28, 29, 30, all of a sudden our talks about, you know, our sort of dinner time conversations with my friends had gone from it being our jobs and this was really exciting and this was happening, and it started to turn a little bit more towards, oh, I think I might have Botox, or I think I might do this, and this sort of weird like rite of passage, but you know, that's been put there. And like, people are having it even younger now with, you know, the idea of preventative Botox, which is obviously being created.
Like preventing aging, basically.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Like, you are going to get older. If you are lucky, there is one sure thing, you will get old and then you'll probably die. And it's really interesting, because one of my friends is a funeral director, and she was like if people worked in my industry, you would see what a privilege it is to get older, because it's, there's nothing more tragic than seeing someone who's really young who's died. She was like, there's nothing more tragic, and it just gives you a real, like, I'm really lucky to be alive point of view on things. And I think that's obviously quite harsh and very bleak, but it is something worth thinking about.
I mean, as somebody who works in the beauty industry, how do you think that whole approach to anti-aging has evolved, if at all?
Yeah, I think brands are a lot more cautious of using the word anti-aging, but that language is still, you know, the ingredients are still there, the language is still there. It takes away that anti-aging focus. Like, you know,
they've just not on the box. Yeah,
it's like brightening or glowing, or like, you know, it gets a different word. I mean, it's better than it being anti-aging, I think, because I think that is such an odd phrase, anti-aging. Like, that sort of battle talk with, you know, the battle against aging, that sort of started to come into our vernacular in the 80s, and it's in a lot of 80s beauty advertising. I think for me, like, that battle, I think, is, I hate that kind of talk, and I think that's really detrimental, because it's not a fight, because there's plenty of other things for women to, you know, have to cope with, let alone having to deal with battling aging. The beauty industry is changing the words a little bit. The intent is still there, but wouldn't it be nice to just buy a moisturizer? Just want a nice moisturizer. Yeah. Just makes my skin less dry. Great. Amazing. Like, you know, that's where I'm hoping things are going and will go.
It's so weird, yeah. Isn't it? Like, you, I worked in tangentially to the industry for a long time. I feel like I'm quite cynical about all that stuff. But show me a product that promises me glow, and I've literally bought it before I've even engaged my brain. What is that about? Why do otherwise smart women, and I'm meaning myself, do that? Why do we buy it, do you think? Intellectually, not like physically buy it, although both, you know.
Yeah, because we had so many years of conditioning to think that the only way to be beautiful is to be young. And like, we've had centuries of that. And particularly since the beauty industry has been around, it sold that pretty much from its start. And I think we are just so conditioned to want that and to pin our hopes on something that might get us that. And before we even can rationalize it, that kicks in. And like, I have done the same, even as someone who's, you know, written a book about this. So, you know, like, if you can sort of just interrupt that for a minute, and I guess this is one of the things one of the tools I sort of give people in the book is just this sort of process of just going, just wait a minute, run through these questions. If you still want it at the end of this, just like, you know, put it aside for a minute and then go back to it. Do you really want it? What do you think this product is going to give you? Because it could be a great moisturizer, awesome, which is amazing. But is it going to change your life? Is it going to make you look 5 years younger or 10 years younger? No, probably not, actually. And it is just, yeah, just taking more control and autonomy back over our choices. And yeah, but the thing is, we will still make those decisions, but it is just knowing why we're making them and, you know, why we're flipping into that, oh, I've got to have it, it's going to change my life mentality, and, you know, anything to get that glow, etc. So it's yeah, I think it is just an automatic reaction that we now have, but I don't think it's something we were born with, and I don't think it's an intrinsic reaction. I think that is something we've been conditioned to do over time.
Yeah, I've internalized it. I've kind of got all the privileges. I'm white, I'm straight. And I felt probably around about your age, around about turning 40 and into my early 40s, was the point when I kind of looked up and thought, where is everyone? What's next? Where do I go? What is that like for you as a brown woman approaching 40?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a couple of interesting factors here in that, I guess, you know, I am single. I would love to have children. So there is a biological thing, which is, you know, like really tricky to navigate, to be totally honest. So there is, you know, there's that side of things. And I guess this is an interesting generational thing as sort of being a millennial, older end of the millennial spectrum.
The geriatric end, yeah.
I do have lots of friends who have decided to not have children, I think, in a way that maybe generations above maybe didn't necessarily. Like, lots of my friends have actually actively decided that they don't want to have kids. And so that's interesting because you see different paths that maybe my parents didn't see, well, you know, wasn't an option for them. So that's quite interesting. But then on the other side of that, like, I'm Asian, I've got dark skin, I've got more melanin in my skin, so I've got more natural sun protection, etc. My skin is basically, I've aged a little tiny bit facially, but generally speaking, I've looked pretty much the same for the last 20 years.
Yeah, no, you look really young. You look really young.
So the interesting thing with this is that I weirdly get hit on by a lot of men in their 20s. And I also dress like, I sort of dress like the goth that I was when I was 15. I haven't really evolved out of that. I mean, it's gotten a little bit more refined, but I look quite young, I guess, my age. And that's really interesting when sort of you're approached by men in your 20s, or even just like people who are younger in their 20s, and they're just like, oh my god, can't believe you're like 39 or whatever. And I think they are like, they think it's a compliment, but it does make you feel worse because it makes you feel old and it makes you feel like out of date. It's just, I hate that feeling. And like, I think if I could get rid of anything, it's that feeling. And I am actively trying to change my social media feeds and stuff to make sure I don't feel like this, because I don't want to feel like after 40 everything's over, or like I want to be excited about the rest of my life. And I think that is a birthright we should all have, is to continue to be excited about our lives and not think. That phrase middle age is something that's really interesting at the moment, because people keep sort of like mentioning it, and I think a lot of male friends actually in particular, I think, are quite scared of it, of this phrase middle age. I mean, what is middle age? Like, how do you define that? I don't know. I, in my head, it's always been about 45, but I think,
yeah, it's literally the middle, isn't it? I mean, that's all.
You know, that phrase middle age is like more of a recent thing. That's not how people used to define the different age groups. There was another way to phrase it. I need to dig that out. And it was really brilliant. And it was almost more of just like a wise age or something like that. And I thought that was really interesting. And I was like, yeah, that is it. Middle age is just a way to make people feel shit, essentially. I actually think we should just take it out of our vernacular, because what does that even mean? You know, if you live till, I don't know, 40, then 20 is your middle age. Like, it literally means nothing. Like, it means nothing. And I think it is just a way to put people in boxes. Like, you could be, I don't know, 40, 50, 60, and I don't know, be having like the best sex of your life, or hitting your career high. And that's amazing. And I just think, like, it's those definitions are so, so toxic. The issue is, I think we need to take control of defining those things, because nobody's going to do that for us. And advertising companies are not going to do that for us. Marketing companies are definitely not, because they just want to focus on whoever is the new young generation, you know. So I just remember it so vividly when I was working at a magazine, and it was the first time this sort of talk of this generation stuff really started to come into play. And before this point, you know, we were the juniors in the office, you know, you had your ideas, etc., but you didn't step above your station. And all of a sudden this word millennial came in, and everyone cared about what we thought. And it was really funny, because I was like, oh my god, this is wild. But then, you know, a few years later, nobody cared about millennials. And it was like, that was over and you've been discarded then for the next group. And these whole groups, these sort of aging categories, you know, these generations are defined so people can sell us things. That is literally it. Probably some white guy in a boardroom, you know, like decided that was a thing. And now we're being defined by it. Entire industries are being geared up towards, you know, selling us stuff. And I just think it's really weird that we're doing that, because actually you might have more in common with someone who's like two generations above you than you would like someone in your own generation. I definitely found that.
Yeah, I mean, it is irrelevant, but the madness of the real madness of the white guy in the boardroom who only cares about Gen Z's this 5 minutes is that they aren't the people who've got any money at all. So yeah. It's like he's clearly not any good at his bloody job. But yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, I think that the thing about middle age is that everybody started saying midlife, and then that I just makes me die. It just makes me cringe. So I think that in a way, almost like middle age, there was a slight attempt to reclaim middle age as a, it's not the chinos and the lawnmower and the bungalow and all of that. You know, it's just the middle. That's all it is. It's nothing. But I totally agree with you. It's like, you know, it's all fake. It's like pitting millennials against boomers and whatever. It's just we are who we are. And everybody I know is still the same person that they were. And they still want to wear, like, the number of people I know with goth tendencies, because I think we were like slightly out of it at school, and you tend to veer towards goth as something to give you a bit of an identity. Still the same, we just want the same thing, just probably more expensive.
Yeah, people like say my style is posh goth, and that's very much the case.
It's yes,
from like being Camden goth to, you know, slightly more, I don't know, like slightly more Dior goth, maybe not quite that, but you know. You don't like lose your personality as soon as you like turn 40 or whatever it is. And I think that's definitely true.
I love being in my 50s. I think 40s is the bit where you feel like, oh, it's all over now. And also you like get menopause. And it's like, I kind of felt like once I got to 50, I was like, oh, it's actually great, because I'm just me. All of that other stuff that kind of bogs you down in your 30s, the timeline stuff, it's kind of gone. And you kind of got over that little hump where you're like, oh, it's all over now. And it isn't. It's fine. It's not all over. It's just that a whole bunch of people told me it would be.
Yeah, that is, it's that thing where I think if I didn't want children, it'd probably be a bit less of a thing.
Mm.
Because at the moment, I still would. Then I think that's the thing. But yeah, I've got friends who don't want children who are in their 40s or like about to be 40 who are just like, yeah, this is great. I'm really excited about my next career thing, or I'm really excited about my next travel thing, and, you know, whatever it is. But yeah, I think that is the tricky thing. And yeah, obviously there is a biological element to that. I just even think the way that, you know, quite often age groups are sort of like something to 35. I think there was just so much focus on that, like that number. And as soon as you hit that number, and I remember feeling that very viscerally, I was like, oh God, I haven't, you know, I think I just split up with someone at 35. And I was like, oh God, like it was just this feeling of doom. And yeah, it's put like a real shadow over each of my birthdays every year. And I really want to, as I come up to 40 next year, just not feel like that. I just don't want to feel like that. And I just don't think any of us deserve to feel like that. And I just, yeah, I hope that there is a future generation of women who don't have to feel like that. And if I can help and be part of that solution for them, then I would love that.
Yeah, I hope as more of us to kind of stand up and go, 55, still here, you know, still doing what I do, still really enjoying it. I hope as more and more people do it, of different backgrounds and races and gender identities, and it will start to become more normalized, I hope. But I think it's a really slow, really slow process. I'm sorry to ask you a beauty editor question, but I can't have you here and not ask you a beauty editor question. So given all of everything that you know about branding and the language that beauty companies use, is there any one product or several products who you think, yeah, they are absolutely worth buying? I definitely would. Or is there not?
No, do you know what? There is. And this is interesting. I still think there is loads of great beauty products out there. I still love beauty products. You know, there are brands that I would probably choose that maybe wouldn't be my cup of tea because I don't like, you know, the way that they do things or et cetera. But I think there are still loads of great beauty products out there, because I do think beauty, like fashion, can be an incredible tool for self-expression. And I think that's where we just need to push that focus, to just take that focus off. I think particularly, I think as you get older, putting your makeup on or your skincare, you look in the mirror and it becomes about, you know, I need to cut, oh my God, my dark circles, I need to cover those. Got a wrinkle here, I need to try and like moisturize that and see if that goes. I need to do this and that and that. And it becomes this sort of almost like this daily routine of beating yourself up about getting older. And I think if we can shift out of that a little bit, I think that is a really important mindset sort of change. And I guess one of the ways I think that you can do that is to focus on slow beauty. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, but and for me, that concept is just about, well, number one, it is about slowing down and buying things more mindfully and not sort of just buying in that beauty anxiety mode when we see something on social media or, you know, or on a forum or wherever it is that tells us it is going to take 20 years off us in 5 minutes or etc. But it's also about enjoying beauty products again, because I think because there is such a vast amount, there is, I think it does take the enjoyment out of things. And, you know, if you can use a cream because you love the way it looks, and I'm very visual, I love beautiful things. And, you know, like the packaging is a really important thing to me. So if I love the way a pot looks in my bathroom, like I really enjoy using it, or the smell of products, or, you know, the textures, or just something that makes you feel amazing because of the way it makes you feel, because of all those amazing sensorial things, I think that is the way forward. And then particularly with makeup, for it not to be this sort of, I guess, you know, to use that word, war paint, it's not war paint. There you are not going into battle against yourself or against your face or aging. It's not like covering up your circles or covering things up or masking things or hiding. It's about expressing just how you feel. It's about expressing yourself and expressing how you feel on the inside, on the outside. And that's something I keep coming back to, is that beauty and fashion are these amazing tools to sort of do what you want with your own canvas. And we've lost that along the lines when, you know, this whole like sort of anti-aging stuff has been pushed on us. We've lost that along the lines. And I think that is the way to reclaim it, is to wear an amazing red lipstick because you love red lipstick, or to like wear the goth eye that, I don't know, you used to wear when you were a teenager. And I do think quite often when we do sort of feel tired and, you know, we don't like the way we look, or I don't know, we sort of shift into that focus where we're sort of trying to hide everything. I think it's because we are trying to get back to that point where we were our authentic selves, and that's what we need to focus on. It's like, you know, how do I feel the most myself? Yeah, it's definitely something to think about, I think, when people do their, you know, do their routines and put on their makeup, etc.
Yeah, don't see it as something to fix you. It's about expression, not solving a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the concealing. It's not any of that. It's self-expression. That is what makeup is. And even from its earliest days and sort of, you know, in the ancient periods, it was a ritual and it was adornment and it was quite ceremonial. And I think if we can bring those elements back, then I just think it just takes the edge off that constant soundtrack that just goes, like, you look old, you look tired. Oh, you look really tired. I literally did it to myself this morning. I looked at myself and I went, oh, you look really tired. I am really tired.
Not that you look tired, it's that you are tired.
You know, I am tired of, you know, the bullshit we're being fed. I'm also tired. I'm also tired because I haven't had enough sleep. And, you know, maybe that is a self-care element then. We can sort of ditch the self-care because we do, generally speaking, put others, you know, above and beyond and before ourselves. So, you know, maybe that is something to look at. If there is someone out there who is like, oh, I feel so tired, maybe you do need some self-care. And the self-care thing has become a huge like buzzword and a big marketing thing. And that doesn't mean you have to buy anything to do self-care. Self-care is free. And the biggest kind of self-care you can do is, and statistically, and this is, you know, proven over and over again by studies across the world, the best thing you can do for your self-care is to have community. And community can come through amazing podcasts like this and friends and family, etc. So you can get it in lots of different ways.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's just been subverted as something else to buy. Right. I'm going to ask you the questions that I always ask at the end. So what's your emotional age?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I would say it's probably about 30. I'm still very excited by stuff and can be slightly childlike. I just really love the things I've always loved. So I love going to gigs. I love going to see bands. I still get a lot of enjoyment from the things I was doing in my 20s, etc. So I guess it maybe sits a bit younger than maybe the things that lots of people are potentially doing in their late 30s. I don't know.
Give us a book recommendation. So what book would you push on a friend? It could be something you've loved a long time, or it could just be something good that you read recently.
I am going to say Patti Smith's Just Kids. I think that is
brilliant. Yeah.
I like try and reread it every few years. I mean, it's such a great snapshot into a period of time, and Patti Smith is amazing and another one of these very inspirational people. I've always been obsessed with her, and like used to try and dress like her when I was at uni and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think super aspirational, did things on her own terms. And also just every time I read that book, I feel really inspired about writing again. I think sometimes, particularly as a writer, you need that. And sometimes, yeah, it can get a little bit samey sometimes. So yeah, I think that is something that everyone would love.
Would she also be your old bird role model?
Ooh, yeah, potentially. Yeah. Yeah, I reckon so. I just like that she's always done her own thing. But I'm also obsessed with Cindy Gallop.
Yes, yes.
Obsessed. with her. She's like a friend of a friend, so I'm like always trying to be like, can you introduce us? So I love her approach, and she did an amazing video on YouTube talking about just like her dating life and stuff, and I just was like, oh my god, I want to see more women like you everywhere. I just thought she was amazing.
Yeah, she's brilliant. And it's like every birthday she like really shouts about it. She's like, yes, I am like 61 now, I'm 62 now, just like, and she's just totally doing her own thing. She's great.
Yeah, I love her.
What advice would you give younger women?
Just have some time off social media. And yeah, that sounds really boring and a bit like a slightly lecturing thing that someone older than you might say, and I probably would have not listen to that at their age. But I would just say, just come out of that bubble a little bit and try and just find things beyond that, just because I just don't think it's doing anyone's mental health very much good. But also to just make your own decisions. And I think that's something each generation faces. But yeah, just to try and just keep as much autonomy over yourself and your decisions as you possibly can. And whether that's beauty or fashion or, you know, your career or whatever you decide to do in life, whether you have children, whether you don't, whether you get married, you know, your sexuality, everything, just try and keep your sense of self and your autonomy as you go through life. And it's really hard. But I think if you can always come back to what you love, what lights you up, then that is a really good thing to have.
That's good advice. What's your superpower?
Got very fast reflexes, weirdly. So that would be one. I've got ADHD, and a lot of people think that that's a superpower. I don't know if I'm fully of that belief, because I really struggled with it when I was younger. And a lot of the things that caused me a lot of grief were ADHD related. I was only diagnosed a few years ago in adult life. So yeah, that's been quite an interesting journey. And quite a lot of grief in that as well, to sort of like look back at my younger years and sort of, yeah, just put a reason to the way that I felt the way I did about things, or why I couldn't remember things, or, you know, just all of that. But within that, I guess I'm very good at seeing shifts in patterns and behaviors and sort of noticing patterns. So that's quite a weird superpower, in that I can always see when something is going to change. So almost like a pattern of behavior is going to change. So I'm very good at trend forecasting, weirdly.
That's, it's
like
really useful.
Really useful, yeah. But I'm almost like, in terms of journalism, I'm always like too far ahead of my time. So, but people don't really care about that right now. So yeah, it's getting bad, but it's interesting.
And last one, how many fucks do you give?
I want to be a place where I say I give zero fucks. I probably give, if it was a scale of 10 of fucks, I would probably give 5 fucks. Because sometimes it's good to care, you know, what people think, and to be mindful of people's experiences and people's opinions and stuff. And I have a lot of time for that. I would say 5. And then I think, yeah, probably as I get older, I'm hoping it will maybe go down to about a 3. But I don't know if I'd want to go below a 3, because I still think it's good to be open and receptive to what people have to say and, yeah, other people.
That's brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to support The Shift further, please consider becoming a member of our community. Find out more at steady.media/The Shift.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.